Voices of VR podcast. Hello, my name is Kent Bai, and welcome to the Voices of VR podcast. It's a podcast that looks at the structures and forms of immersive storytelling and the future of spatial computing. You can support the podcast at patreon.com/voicesofvr. So continuing my series of looking at IFA DocLab 2025, today's episode is with a piece called Deep Soup by Luna Maurer and Raoul Wouters. So this is a film that's a participatory film, and so it's kind of like a sci-fi, poetic, you know, a lot of abstractions within it. And it took me a couple of times to watch through it to kind of understand some of the different deeper points that they're saying. And part of the confusion is that they're using a lot of the film submissions as these kind of poetic verbs that, if you're not familiar with the verbs that they're using, then it kind of took me a couple of times to watch through it. But it's a piece that is critiquing AI in different ways. And so there's an AI character named O, and throughout the piece, they're kind of feeding O these different images that are these user-generated cinematography shots that there's probably like 100 people that are credited. And so in these, there's different dialectics for each of these different scenes, whether things are floating or sinking or falling or floating in the air, breaking, they've got rolling, and there's also like collapse versus like being static. And so as the AI is watching it, the AI is not able to really kind of discern at what point any of these processes are unfolding, at what point they are at. And so the AI gets kind of confused. And so a big part of this is showing that the deeper point that in the world, we have a lot of applications, and all those applications are trying to solve a problem. And that the view of technology that is that it's trying to create this frictionless existence for us. And then, so they're using a lot of metaphors of friction to try to bring back friction. And they have a whole kind of design manifesto. That's one that's called conditional design that they found previously. But the second design manifesto they did was called designingfriction.com, where they have a lot of these different principles where they're trying to really encourage people to reinvigorate friction as a part of ways that we're engaging with other humans. And that's really kind of the magic of what it means to be human, is to have these relationships that are coming from ways that we're kind of bumping up against each other, because our life isn't frictionless, but we're kind of living into a future where everything is trying to be designed so that we live in this frictionless world. So we're covering all that and more on today's episode of the Voices of VR podcast. So this interview with Luna and Raoul happened on Tuesday, November 18th, 2025 at IFA DocLab in Amsterdam, Netherlands. So with that, let's go ahead and dive right in.
Hi, my name is Luna Maurer, and I used to have a company together with Raoul Wouters sitting next to me, and we were called Moniker, and with Moniker we were doing a lot of interactive participatory projects, a lot of them online, also immersive projects you could say, but very diverse, different experiences, lots of time playful and dealing with digital technology and the effects digital technology has on our everyday life.
Hello, my name is Raoul Wouters, and I used to have a studio called Moniker together with Luna Maurer, who is sitting next to me. And we did basically the same things, as she just said, so she said it very well. It was very well put, Luna. And besides that, but we already stopped this studio like 2 years ago. And currently we are developing our own individual practices. But for this special occasion, we collaborated on a new film project called Deep Soup. And now it sounds as if that was a short project. That was not the case. It took us, I think, more than 4 years to, from the beginning until the end, maybe five even, Luna. And that's what we talk about today, about our new project and short experimental science fiction film about the value of the physical world in relation to the digital world where we're so often in. And we somehow to seem that we notice or we feel that is more important or more prominent or more invasive at times, especially for our children, than the physical world that is right in front of us.
Nice. Looking forward to diving into the entirety of the project. But before we do, I always like to hear from what kind of design disciplines people are bringing in, and so what kind of training and what kind of things you're bringing in into your artistic practice. So just a bit more context as to your background and your journey into the space.
Well, I was studying at the Art Academy, and I finished in 1999. I studied graphic design, and I did a master in digital media, you could say. And I, in 1999, I remember my final exam was an alternative proposal for a desktop metaphor that's supposed to be liquid, fluid, where folders melt into one another. So I always wanted to, or it was interested in this digital realm. And besides that, I love crafting all kinds of things outside, you know, and I love dancing as well. So I'm trying to also bring, you know, movement and the meaning of movement into my practice.
I was also educated as a graphic designer, and that was the time, yeah, the early 2000s, that the web as it does now didn't really exist yet, and new media was still sort of very fresh term, and we were working with DVD burning and like zip discs. That was the time, and at that time, the web and technology as a phenomenon or as a yeah, there was a quite an optimistic idea about what technology could do. There was this promise of democratization, emancipation, and we all thought we would share knowledge and somehow get like people who are in niche groups all together and create communities all around the world. So there was this momentum. And we were trained as graphic designers, but we felt like, hey, we need to somehow, because this graphic design was very much focused on producing end results, on like fixed, because there was a printing press, on something that was would be fixed. And we were very interested, me and Luna and also Jonathan, who was at the time also our partner, in way more dynamic systems. So we were thinking about like how can we find a format in, yeah, what's the new role of a designer in a world where nothing is fixed and everything is constantly changing. And that led us to writing a manifesto. And we called that the conditional design manifesto, because we realized it's not so much about like the end result, about designing an end result, but designing the conditions in which something can happen. And I think that really that thought, which is now like very common ground for every like new media designer, was at that time was very much a sort of epiphany for lots of people thinking that you could design in that way. And with that we really did all kinds of talks, performances, workshops, works all over the world.
Yeah, I actually came across the conditional design manifesto and I was taking a look at it before our chat and noticed that it was very process-oriented. You're really focusing on the process, but also that there's a certain logic that's involved. And so maybe you could just elaborate a little bit more in terms of like if this was really born out of trying to go beyond any singular design discipline and trying to create more of a process by which that you could iterate with a group, or just trying to understand a little bit more around how you would describe what conditional design is.
Well, as Ruhl already very well put it, we were interested in designing environments, frameworks in which a process can take place, but we were actually very much interested in people and human characteristics. So we thought if we design a system very precisely with logic and have people engage or interact or play in such a system, then we are able to crystallize basically that what doesn't fit within. This way we thought we could emphasize our specific human flavor, funny, weird ideas. People also started to hack then the system or try to overcome the limitations. And that was really so exciting. So sometimes we saw ourselves almost like social scientists, you know?
Puppeteers.
Trying to find the sweet spot.
You put it so perfectly nice, but do you have an example of a work that along those lines?
Yeah, of course. There are so many examples. For example, a very simple example I can explain now is the Fungus series. That is a sticker sheet with four stickers on the sheet, like let's say rectangular stickers. We did all kinds of different sticker shapes. And then you get into the museum and you get a sticker and you're supposed to glue it on the floor but attach it or in the neighborhood of an existing sticker. And there were very few rules attached to it, but people would start to cheat instead of, you know, tearing the sticker apart in order to have more control, because with only four stickers, you cannot influence the bigger picture. And people feel like, hey, I want to have more influence. So that is what these limitations of only having four stickers triggered this basically creativity of people to do things that we're not supposed to.
And this was all in a time that we were still very optimistic about how these systems at large would somehow, like how we as society and as people and as humans would benefit from this sort of, yeah, there was a sort of a techno-optimist or at least system-optimist perspective. But that changed over the years. And yeah, that led also to a new manifesto, a second manifesto.
Is it about friction?
There you go, the magic word. We wrote the, or we can also call it statement, maybe rather than manifesto, designing friction statement, a call for friction in digital culture. And in this, we make an analysis of the concept of friction, what friction actually is, what we mean with it, why digital technology tries to eliminate it, remove friction, create seamless experiences, and how can we bring friction back into our digital culture. So we come up with five proposals, and we also state or emphasize the necessity of friction in our lives in order to feel alive.
Yeah, I think like for a long time as a designer, basically the practice is like this. You look at the world, identify a problem, find a solution, and capitalize on the solution. Right? That was for years like how designers work. And that also, say, started off this whole big tech reality where we're in now, where somehow always there's this promise of, okay, you have this problem in your life. You cannot navigate on your only your eyes and your map. But we hear this app, and we give you the solution for a Google Map, and your life will be better. Like small problems are solved constantly. Every app, basically, you can see on your phone is somehow the promise of a better life. And that in itself is, like you could say, is a very generous thing to do. But as a side effect, we also lose contact with humanity, with the human factor of things. The fact that you have to argue at the moment that you're with your partner in a car driving to Paris, and then what's the shortest route or how do you get to around the periphery, that makes the pizza tasting and the beer afterwards way better. It's way different than if you just like sit behind your Netflix and you just don't know exactly what happened, and all of a sudden you're in Paris. Who cares? It doesn't really matter anymore. So we identified that the responsibility of a designer that before was only identifying problems, solving them, now also comes with the responsibility, an added responsibility, to see, say, like, hey, if you, with your product, with your digital product, also remove the human factor somehow or way, you have to do that very consciously, or at least be conscious about it. And as Luna just said, you can also think or consider adding some friction where somehow there's a touch point with the reality, the physical reality around you, as part of your responsibility as a designer. That's in a nutshell, it is this manifesto for friction. So it has nothing to do with world problems of saying like, hey, we're so spoiled. It's more about like, how do we want to sort of shape the reality that we're in?
Yeah, it's one thing to add maybe that we would wish that in digital culture with digital tools, digital environments that we create, that we want, we propose that we should design them in such a way that people engage in them much more with their whole body, or with much more with all senses being getting together, rather than everybody isolated, smooth behind their screens. Right. And yeah.
Yeah, it seems like that in the theme of Deep Soup, there seems to be this contrast between this frictionless kind of abstraction of with our mind and interacting in these kind of virtual ethereal realms mediated by the networked internet and the digital technology versus the materiality of living in the world and the physicality embodied in environments that are collisions with the world in a way that has gravity and friction, and that there's a sense of trying to get away from these pure abstractions and the theoretical aspects into more of the kind of embodied and empirical aspects of life is sort of what I got.
100%. That's 100% correct. Yeah. So we really want to embrace and engage people interacting, and also ourselves even engage more physically in the world, because I feel that makes you much more happy in the end. Yeah. well, we can talk about more, but yeah.
Nice. And so maybe you could talk around how you're taking these ideas of friction and then going on this journey of deep soup. Where did you begin with this project?
Okay. I'm not answering your question exactly now, because just what fitted very well what we said beforehand is that with deep soup, it's a story and it's a beautiful film, participatory film, but we wanted to make a tool, like an example of this friction design idea, where we ask people to film things, gravity basically, capture gravity with their camera in the world and send us in those films. And we wanted not so much that people film things for us, but rather also for them to have a physical experience, look again in front, how do things look like and how can I look at them differently? And for example, I was at dinner with my daughter and my husband, and usually there was a storm outside, it was a bit rainy, and usually we would sit and look behind the screen, read your emails, and then I said, no, let's go outside. Let's make a film about something floating in the air. And I dragged them outside, not really, okay, let's do it. And then we had the best time of our life. We had so much fun playing 1.5 hours in the rainy storm, trying to make super nice, capturing something flying in the air. And I was so happy in the afterwards, you know, and so that, like, this is exactly, oh, sorry, yes, this is like this kind of thing. So we feel like we want to make something where people think like, okay, let's have fun. Let's play together again. Yeah.
Yeah. But I think it's nice about, because you could say it's a bit counterintuitive if you say, okay, you want to remove, get people away from the screens and then make like some sort of interactive participatory things where everybody has to use their camera to make something that's again on the film. But what Luna just outlined, I think, is very central in this piece. These are all exercises you have to do with the two of you. And you really have to look at the here and now around you and capture that. But that, I think, was already way more not unnecessary to repeat.
Yeah, but I also think it's nice that we use a phone. It's not that we say ditch all technology. It's like it's a combination of both, right? Yeah. Use the technology that we have. We have slow-mo functionality on your camera, your cell phone. You use this tool and the physical world, you know, both, and people together around you. So, and that's what I like. And then come all together and watch in the end the film together on the screen. That's also part of it.
Yeah, I think that's also an interesting focus we realized. I think I realized yesterday also, but I think it was also already discussed before that we really try to now, suppose on the beginning or mid of our career, we were really busy with somehow orchestrate, like crystallize human, sort of the human aspect through sort of digital systems often. But now it's also somehow, it includes also getting people together in a physical space. So the cinema as a space where people come together and enjoy something is something, it's fundamentally different than swiping on your phone. And the idea that you first all are like separated, you all get this instructions and you have to throw something on the floor and you submit that to the project, whatever. And then you all come together and you're watching this film together. It's like such an... a physical experience nearly, although it's on the screen.
No, but it's totally physical. You have to go through the city, you get there, you have a drink, you sit down. There are all these transitional moments that are part of this thing, you know?
I think practice. You as a performer are also like way more busy with like, how do I as a person and a body relate to the audience that is in front of me live? That's really a sort of a shift in practice. And I think also the things that I do, like as my in my personal practice, are also always related to how technology in a space manifests and what it does to the people who enter those spaces. To me, it's relatively new. I've always thought as the digital realm as a space, the virtual space. And I'm like way, way less interested in the virtual space as a destination or as a format or a platform. Also not really existing anymore, I think, like that. It's just the platforms like TikTok and Instagram, that's what the web is as a social whatever. And then I want to make big, very big quotation marks there. But so I think that's kind of sad also. We can just state that said that the web as a platform where people come together really as a destination somehow has changed? Or am I getting old? Is Reddit still there? I don't know.
I think that there's certainly one of the things that Casper Sonen said in the opening night was sort of the paradox of how the internet was supposed to bring us together, but yet it has this sort of alienating effect. So I think that we have this kind of dissociative experience of becoming numb and distracted, and the algorithm ends up dictating our lives in a way. So I feel like there's a ways that, you know, it's had this promise of like empowerment and connectiveness, and it's sort of disempowering and taking away agency in some ways. So yeah, I feel like right now we're at a moment where we're really reflecting on the impact of the internet and digital technologies over the last like 36 years. And DocLab was sort of created in that halfway point of the early beginnings of the internet. And DocLab was in 2007. It was iPhone came out. There's a lot of optimism for digital technologies. And so now at a similar amount of time between when the internet started and when DocLab started, now we're at that point where now we're kind of like reflecting upon all of this. And I feel like your project's doing that in a lot of ways.
I also feel that, although you could say that's it's also, if I think back, there's way more media criticism, and media criticism, I also mean platform and digital sort of media awareness, actually, than like 10 or 15 years ago. So that's the positive side of this, that I feel like lots of people, although they cannot resist the temptations of TikTok and Instagram, they're very aware of the fact that somehow has this impact, and people are willing to discuss this and debate and try to polish this in one way or another. So that's a positive note.
Yeah. No, I observe that we are always resonating very much thematically with the theme of DocLab every year, basically, because with the year we were talking about writing the designing friction statement, phenomenal friction was the theme of DocLab. Now it's off the internet. Our project is getting people off the internet. So it's...
I suspect Casper to somehow have like a sort of spy coming by.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it could be that you're just tuned into the zeitgeist of the larger zeitgeist. But speaking of the friction in the beginning of encouraging friction, was that the year that you did an opening presentation of DocLab? Was that around friction?
Yeah. Yeah, well, we wrote this statement and we had communications with Casper. I'm sure he was maybe also a little bit inspired. And
he was a little bit inspired. Wink, wink.
And then we said, hey, yeah, but we want to do something at the exhibition because that's our thing. And he was, yeah, please do something for the opening. And then actually something crazy happened because there were lots of,
there was a protest that happened because the war in Gaza had just started underway, and then there were some protests, and then they weren't really handling it all that well, and so then they released a statement and another statement. They ended up releasing like three statements, and it was not satisfactory to anybody, and so it was sort of like a lot of friction that was happening in the context of if it was a cultural institution responding to this conflict.
And then what happened was that Casper said, no, you cannot do the performance about friction. That's impossible. And I couldn't believe it. Rehearsed so long, and it was so on spot, and it was so good. And then we said, you know, Casper, we might now do the performance for you personally, and you can listen to it. And after you heard that, you tell us again whether we cancel it or not. And he heard it, and he said, wow, please, yes, we have to do it. So we were really happy. Yeah. So that was the story. Yeah.
It was kind of like everything was on like extreme tension then.
But it was really very well received. So that was really nice. So it was also, the necessity. I mean, it is also how you see friction, right? I mean, we were explaining a lot what it is. And let's maybe go too far to go into this now, because everybody can read it online on designingfriction.com. But I think it's a very rich concept, you know, that stems from movement, stems from interaction, but it all relates also to being connected. That actually happens also in the film when, you know, we make a lot of metaphors of this in this Deep Soup film. When you see, for example, a ball rolling over a surface and then a voice says, wow, they dance beautifully together, but they need each other. One can only dance if the other one helps. And it is metaphorically for the fact that an object rolling or tumbling over another surface, they interact in a way, and there is friction, and there is the sort of connection they have together, because it's physics. It's very simple. It stems from gravity and the friction there is. And that is, I think, a very beautiful metaphor for us people together in real life.
It's not even a metaphor. I think it's just a law of nature. Rather than it's not, it feels like
no,
a metaphor.
But you can metaphor to people.
Yeah, but I think it might be the same force, literally, like the fact that you need collision in order to engage. It is not only it's the same mechanic.
Yeah.
So a metaphor, you would also really use something that's basically from an entirely different space. And I think in this case, you could argue it's basically maybe the same force of nature in a different type. It's nice that you have this so on your spot, because it's beautiful. I also think always when I see the film and say, like, this one can only dance if the other one helps, that I think lots of people will see, like, the other one, where's the other one? Because they don't look at the floor or the surface where you engage, where you're constantly attached to as an entity, because it's so present, but it's super, it's like all the time super demanding. But we never negotiate it. We never somehow even see it, because it's always there. But it's actually the force that we're always colliding.
Only if it hurts. Yeah. Then you realize it. Yeah?
Or then you escape it.
Yeah,
and you fly.
For example. But in dance, if you dance, we actually sympathize a lot the floor. But that's very specific. That's completely 100, you know, that's all you have. The floor is the only thing in your body. But in life, I mean, as you say, we never address it.
Well, I wanted to dig into a little bit of the participatory aspect of this piece, because when I first saw Deep Soup, I was sent a screening link and I watched it. And then when I came here to the exhibition, I had seen the request for submissions that you had put out in terms of asking for specific things that you wanted to include in your piece, and then watched each of those different pitches in the installation and then on your Instagram reels that you had to kind of invite people into this participatory project. And then when I rewatched the project again, I was like, oh, okay, here's how what they shot and here's what they were inviting with these different themes. So I was able to kind of see how you're able to kind of create these polarities, like falling, floating, sinking, floating, the sticking and the collapsing. And so you have these contrasts that you're using as a kind of dialectic for this main character of this AI that's trying to discern on what side of the dialectic it's happening. And so just curious to hear this process of this call for entries, but also if before you did that, if you had a pretty clear idea as to the structure of the film that you were going to do, to kind of really understand how these verbs that people were going to be shooting were going to play into the final product.
Yeah, that was all one big construct from the beginning. No, not from the very beginning, of course. But before we started shooting, we knew already, I think for 90% what kind of assignments or what kind of things we wanted to ask and why we needed those things. And then, of course, we made like slightly changes in like we wanted like some tilts or pans or that kind of stuff, like how we actually... But that whole idea about falling and floating and breaking, that was all part of this initial writing that Luna made, like in the very beginning of this project, where she wrote this stream of consciousness, a non-human intelligence would look at the laws of physics, but with the naivety of, you could say, a child, but I think that's not precise enough. But if something breaks, you can see, like, we are so trained to see that as something that is like maybe wrong or destructive, but this entity sees like, is that what you call birth? So it's really about like, hey, this collision, you can see it as death, but you can also see it as something, as the place for something new. That sort of intuitive writing, that let that be both sort of valued as something, as the starting point of the project, as where we built this whole thing around. And that basically let, that always stayed the center of the project, and we built basically this whole construct, this whole film around it,
Yeah, it has many facets, you could say, this work, because it's very, you know, we hope to make it also very cinematographic, you know, with very good DOPs, cinematographers, the film around, and then it has those contributions, this whole campaign, the vlogs that we both become actors in to make people contribute, and it was a lot of work. everything and a lot of filming and then going to all kinds of places, coming up with examples, thinking of small examples that people can get triggered, but also not getting afraid, oh, I have to make such a great film. And then also a little bit, you know, more bigger complex examples. And yeah, I don't know. I feel like this project has lots of facets. It was a lot of work and I hope it's going to live on a little bit a while now, because now that's the first version that we made. And this whole construct of this film is set up in such a way that we can easily put in new contributions. If another community would say, hey, a festival or whatever, an organization say, let's make our own version of this film because we want our folks to also play with all those instructions, and then we can do a new version.
You could imagine that another version of this project where, like, other people, what just Luna explained, do you think it would add to the project if you would be able to browse, for example, multiple versions?
Well, I think the film itself, it helped me to watch it a couple of times because it wasn't immediately clear when the kind of user-generated content was coming in. And so to kind of understand the themes based upon what you were requesting around these different dialectics of, you know, it's, you know, stable and collapsing. Is it falling? Is it floating? Is it rolling? Is it breaking? You know, all these requests that you're putting out, like these primary verbs, I had that in my mind as I was watching it the second time. And then I was like, oh, okay, here's how those verbs are playing in as a metaphor, and how this main character is actually confused as to, you know, this ethereal AI O character who is trying to understand, like, what is happening in the scene and not really quite understanding it as this metaphor for how, as AI reads all of our data, it doesn't really have any understanding. It's just kind of like mashing things together. And so it's this idea that there are fundamental things that you can only learn by living an embodied experience, and having, within the context of neuroscience, it's like embodied cognition, where we have these embodied experiences where we learn around the world. And when you put these systems that have no embodied experiences or world models, then it starts to break out into the abstractions and it gets a lot of things wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah. So thank you very much for putting it so well. That was exactly the challenge when writing, that we imagine it's written from outer perspective of a character that doesn't know gravity. It doesn't have an understanding of gravity, but sees all these things that are happening here and doesn't understand what is happening. So therefore makes a completely different interpretation of it. But then how to write that without using those words of falling or breaking, that was really difficult. To write something with words about these phenomena without using these specific words, but other interpretations, so descriptions, yeah. Mm. But that's also the fun part. It was the challenge, right? And what could you see in it, you know? That was, I mean, the fact that water is seen in this film as a portal, like somebody that controls here. Like, some may enter, others are not allowed in because they drift on the surface. And yeah, so these visions, these imaginations of water as something that is in control of something, yeah, this is what we really like, you know. And hopefully this also comes across for the audience when they listen to it.
Yeah, I think, like, what you're, the participatory aspect that you were referring to is like something that was, I think, is also a topic on itself. And sorry, let's go back, because you were in the middle of something. I realize now I don't want to interrupt you like that. No, I just was like completely spacing out. Like, you were like asking about the participatory, and I was thinking like about the dilemma. Okay, I'm blacking out.
Luna, did you have anything that you wanted to jump in?
I don't know you want to talk about participation, we were just talking about the interpretation. An entity that doesn't, well, I hope that it is beautiful for people to listen and look at the world as what they recognize right away, things are full, but hear a different story about it. I don't know how that feels. For me, this is so really clear, obviously, but I don't know. How was it for you?
The first time I watched it, there was a lot of things that I didn't quite understand the first time around. And then when I saw the primary verbs that you were asking for, and then I rewatched it, I think I understood what was happening a little bit more. Because it is a bit of a kind of abstract science fiction film. And so I'm entering into a new logic. And like, what is the logic? And so I think the first time around, I was like, what is the logic of this world? And then when I saw like, oh, this is how you were asking around these specific concepts and ideas. And I was like, oh, okay, well, that actually, you know, I wonder if I would have seen that first, if I would have understood more of the concepts of the film. So then when I watched it again, then I understood more of the ways that you were using these primary words that often had like an opposite, either it's falling or floating. And so then, like I said, the main character in the film represents this AI is trying to discern things. And so, and you know, another thought that came up was that there's this dialectic between substance metaphysics and process relational metaphysics, meaning that there's a world with substance metaphysics where you tend to see the world as these static concrete objects and that's the only thing you see, and then more of a process relational philosophy is that things are dynamic and unfolding or are continually changing, and that this AI is in this substance metaphysics perspective thinking that, oh, this is just static, and then all of a sudden it falls and he's like, oh wait, and it can't quite understand how it's going from one state to the next. It can maybe identify static shots, but in terms of an entity, it doesn't really understand the dynamic flow of what it means in the world because it has no reference point. And so I think in this film, it's sort of like showing this like, oh, it might be able to identify a fixed moment and of a state, but not really understand the full context of how things are unfolding in a process. And so that was sort of what I was focusing on the second time that I watched it.
I'm really glad to hear you talk about it. That's very rich. I love it that these thoughts get triggered when somebody watches this like that. So that makes me really happy. But another question is, if you would, the first time you watch it and you wouldn't get it, the thing that you do get, or the how's the experience then? Is it then just missing something?
Well, no. So I think it's sort of like difficult because I've seen like all the other experiences here, and so it was sort of like as I was preparing to come here, I watched the screener and then I was like, okay, but then there's an installation component, so then I was like getting more information. So it's a little bit of like a detective, to because I'm also doing an interview, so because I'm doing an interview, then I want to kind of dig in a little bit more and see like, well, maybe there's something that I missed or I don't get.
If you would just see it as a poem, so we also somehow trust, like we know there will not be like so many people like you, Kent, who completely dive into it. I mean, we would really love to, but we also are realistic and not everybody will do that. But I sense, and what I felt, and I also get back from people watching it, that they only get like very, like, they don't get it really as a thing. And it's also not necessary. I think it's also nice that it's more as a poem that just hints towards this concept that you are just so beautifully describing, and maybe not completely understand. And I think that's also fine in certain ways, that it just sort of opens it up a bit. And the other thought that I had, like, now we had this first version with all people from our own bubble and the Doc Club bubble and basically the people who are sort of participants. We're also super curious to see what it does to the meaning of the film and the substance of the film if a completely different group of people would make these assignments and these contributions, and whether that somehow also eats into the meaning a bit, or if that different context would also create like a slightly different perspective or narrative in the story. Of course, the voice will not change and the whole logic will not change, but yeah, that's something that I maybe we aim for also, that at one day that we will be able to make a work where this is really in an elegant balance, where the contributions made like intuitively would really inform the story and give it an angle or an edge in a different way.
Yeah, just a quick response in terms of like recalling my first impressions of the piece was that, you know, it's a piece called Deep Soup. I'm gathering by either the synopsis or just kind of watching it that it's a metaphor for artificial intelligence. We're sort of throwing all this data into the algorithm. And so it's, you know, we're in this phase where AI is kind of like doing a lot of data colonization. And it's like sucking in all this data. There's usually not much consent and for how that process is happening. And so, you know, as artists, you're sort of like putting all these things into the AI for it to be trained. And then one of the things that really stuck with me was noticing at the end in the credits of like, he had credited over like 100 different contributors. And then that was like, oh, wow, I didn't realize that this was like that so many people. It was really cool to have so many people that were participating rather than generating AI art or something. Of course, it wouldn't make sense for you to do that within the context of this piece, but it was just the sense of like, it's nice to know that there's still people out there that are going through the trouble of collaborating with that many people to create something like this. And so then when I came to Doc Lab, then I realized, oh, well, this was sort of an open call that was put out as an artistic project. And okay, that's how that happened. And so then when I watched the second full time of the film, trying to see how the themes that were in that were kind of related to as verbs that kind of helped me understand the context of the film even more so, and being able to discern, this is a contribution, this is from this verb, okay, this is how that verb is coming in into this moment of the film, and seeing how you're kind of using it. But the first time I saw that, I wasn't making like a translation of like, oh, this image is relative to this concept. And so it was only after I kind of knew the full context of the participatory film that I understood what the film was trying to say, if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally. I'm now a bit not worried, but we will have a screening on Thursday in iCinema. And there we don't give a little introduction before, but we have like two slides in front of the film just supposed to explain that these are real contributions by people. And I worry now a little bit that people get this, because I think it's quite important to understand, if you enter the film, that all those footage is coming from people and is not from us. I mean, that would be very weird.
I think so too. So is it a plan that we can just... Yeah, we could just say like, hey, we just want to give like a short introduction. It's part of the screening. Yeah. I think it's a good idea.
Our physical existence and our voice saying something in front of the film is part of the film. Yeah. It's part of the screening.
Yeah, as I was going through your different calls for entries, you have the very first frame, you have an image of what you're going for, like floating, and it says, give us an image of floating. And, you know, if you put all those into one slide, then you can get a sense of like, here are the things that you were asking for. And that could be also a very quick way of doing that. Because as I was going through, I was just kind of watching him, and I have a habit of screenshotting things I want to remember. It's sort of like a photo diary. And so I was going through, I was like finding that, okay, here's the best moment from this film that shows that, you know. And usually it was the first frame that had that little like instruction, give us a film of something or other. And then, yeah. So anyway, that's a thought.
Yeah, but we will not be able to change the DCP for Thursday. But it's a nice idea. I think also we learned so much from screening it for a live audience. Mm-hmm. That was also, of course, yeah, we are not like, let's say, filmmakers. Like, we are routiniers in lots of aspects in this field, but not per se as filmmakers. And it was very exciting and very nice. And also very stressful, but also very nice to be there together with all these people in this space.
I have a question for you, Kent. Are you more triggered to film something when you see such a vlog, like a call for action, or after seeing the film itself?
Oh, for me personally, I mean, it's hard to say because the film's done and the deadline is passed. So,
we will by South by Southwest or like any other, like we will start it up again.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say, like, in terms of, like, potentially. I mean, I if I was back home and, you know, seeing a new, fresh round or, yeah, it depends on the context and the moment. It's hard for me to know right now, theoretically. So, I mean,
but,
yeah.
But it's a bit of a thought exercise, but if you imagine you wouldn't have seen the film at all, would you be triggered by first just like the mystery about a film that will be screened at something you don't know what it will be exactly and then receive these vlogs? Or you would first see the film and say like, hey, there's a possibility that you can contribute to this film. And these are the examples. If you compare those two scenarios, what would you... I asked this also.
Yeah, I think so. After seeing the film, I'm more likely, because there's like the shot of a skateboard with shoes on it that doesn't have any feet or legs, and it's just rolling down. And I was like, oh, that must be a rolling one. And that's really interesting that someone decided to do a rolling of a skateboard with shoes, which is not something you would necessarily expect. And I was like, oh, that's fun that they saw that contribution. And like, oh, this is surprising and novel, and it includes in the film. So it's sort of like an exercise to see like what would be fun or interesting that would be.
You also think already about like the selection procedure and what will make the cut or not. So that's also, I can imagine that's also, we never really considered that to be a big factor for people to decide to contribute or not. But I think it's really true. People are like so excited to see their own, of course, their own contributions on the screen. And there's no place for everybody to be featured prominently. So you probably think it, strategic about this as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the second time I watched it was sort of like recognizing the contributions of other people and really appreciating the novelty of some of the ones that were very unique things that maybe went way beyond what you were even expecting for that as a concept, but it's sort of giving you more of a palette of things to work with as you're creating it. So it's just this idea of like the contributions making it like more of a richer, interesting experience for everyone.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, they're also very different qualities. Yeah. Somebody yesterday told me, yeah, but the one in New York with the balls floating in the air, that's not a contribution, right? This is really your footage.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, no, of course. Why would we all of a sudden put it in our own, you know? Why would we do that? It's very funny because it was definitely, yeah, but the camera was so good, you know? The quality was so high. What kind of mobile phone is that? Yeah, and then you see also very crappy, shitty, pixelated.
Somebody throwing a remote control on the couch, which we both really love because of it's like was so badly compressed and like so few frames. But it's just that we felt like that. You think about these people. Okay, I will just do it. Here's my. I will just throw it. And there's also a conceptual. I like them both. Yeah, I think it's just, but that's like conceptually so strong. You know, you say, okay, get rid of the remote control. And there's like this whole layer of like sort of thinking behind, but not filming per se. And I think that is nice if you zoom into all the details of people who things. Yeah.
But also those facts. Yeah, what I like so much about these collection of those contributions that they're all so different and each of them is really beautiful just to watch the movement because most of the movements are captured in slow motion and then you all of a sudden it's still sort of you look at the movement and then you can see so much beauty in these movements that are it's just a throw of this thing but actually you see how it turns and how the colors of the different buttons of the remote control and the sofa where somebody sat. And, you know, there's so much beauty all of a sudden in all those little things that I think that comes for me across. Yeah.
Yeah, I did want to ask around your thoughts on AI because it seems like this film overall is making commentary and you're creating this whole idea of like a physical model that it's training, which is sort of like a antithesis to something that's more abstract or intellectual or intelligence model. It's more physical. And so, but as I was watching it, the word that came to mind is like this metaphor for AI slop where you kind of have this green, slimy type of water where you're throwing these contributions of these images into this soup, the deep soup, as it were. But love to hear any reflections on AI or that prompts that really were catalyzing for you to create this piece that is in some ways trying to deconstruct it or have other ways for people to do something that is not what's happening now.
Well, talking about AI, I mean, we said it at the beginning of this conversation, I think, that we are very worried and critical about the fact that all these concepts that come along with AI is all about comfort and ease and I don't have to bother, it's going by itself, it does it for you, you don't have to sweat anymore, it's all the labor is done and all this bubble that we get in, becoming friends with a machine. And so this worry basically, it's not about, oh, the machines take over our work, it's not that. It's really this mindset that it creates in us humans and taps into this basically thing that we like work to get away from us, but in the end this is not how we get connected in the world. So this critique basically, or that's why we celebrate this physicality of the world with this film basically. That's why we want to reactivate to see, hey, look how much joy this is and not the ease and automatism. That's why the main character O, that sort of is a representation as well of the AI, you could say. We refer to it as a world it's come from where everything is smooth, soft, glides past each other, eternal harmony. Everything is, you know, like that.
I think another problem with AI, or maybe a contradiction in AI somehow, as we see it as a society, it feels as something very novel, as something that's new is entering our lives. But also we must realize that all the data it's trained on is all from the past. So it is nothing that's in this thing is somehow about the future. It's only like a big mix of, you could say, nostalgic, or at least like things from the past, because literally these are all recordings, writings that happened back in time. So it's very weird that somehow we see there's a future of something. There's a future in AI, but basically there's no future in there. And I think that's also the most repulsive thing about this. That it's never really proposing something truly new, but somehow it's disguised as something new. And yeah, so that as a sort of weird juxtaposition in our heads also played a role in trying to... We also didn't want to sort of make it a complete AI bash, or like completely say, okay, this is not... Because it's so easy and it's also happening so often. So we really try to find a perspective that was not so much about like only ranting or judging AI, but somehow also trying to somehow present it in a way that, yeah, we somehow are. Yeah, there it also stops a bit in my head. Therefore, maybe it's also, yeah. So, yeah, you want to say something? Okay, yeah, continue then.
Yeah, if finish first.
So we wanted to not just only judge it, but also somehow try to find a space where it can exist and can coexist, but then somehow in relation to the physical world. And that, of course, can also be both dystopian, but maybe it's also something super nice that's a bit unknown. And we felt like, on the one hand, this AI is like naive and it's sort of seeing the world, the physical world, as a complete new something, and has this like beautiful perspective. And on the other hand, it's also maybe if you really were able to train it, maybe it's also able to shift our world physically completely upside down and really start playing with the rules of gravity. Anyway, yeah.
I wanted to mention that we were also in the process quite a long time busy with thinking in which way can we integrate AI also, in sense of that the script would be altered by the user contributions? No, through the... So the user contributions would be fed and then the voice would be altered, the script would be altered based on the contribution. So that was the plan as well for a while. And then we realized that we have made quite many experiments and in the past project with prompt where AI were writing things, and we realized that it wouldn't work out. We were sure that we would be better in the end if we just decide we're precise and we know what we want exactly say, and not having the sometimes funny, sometimes to the point, but a lot of times also maybe shitty versions. So we sort of decided, no, let's not do it. Yeah, let's go back to the traditional way, basically, of the authorship.
Yeah, so I also feel that we can say more about AI by not using it in this context than actually using it. And it's really about that uncanny feeling that somehow AI, and when you use it as a sort of co-creator, it's often like so boring. It's like often so boring. So
we got bored.
But somebody else asked you, like, so there's no AI in here in this whole film? You didn't use anything, like no prompt writing, nothing, not a single improvement on the script or anything? And I could confidently say no, but then... That's not true. We have, like, at the moment you start uploading your contribution, there is an analysis made, because we thought, okay, this, we have an analysis made, and then the voice of O, or the character, or like any sort of abstract voice, gives comment to the things that you do based on an AI analysis. And we also did that because, yeah, we did that also. Yeah, we did it also because we somehow also agreed, as contractually agreed, that the AI should be part of it. But I think even for that, I think also we, it's not that we don't want to play with it. It's not that we don't want to sort of investigate in this space at all. We're also very curious, but we don't really see like benefits for like an authorship position.
Nice. And finally, as we start to wrap up, I'd love to hear what each of you think the ultimate potential for this type of immersive art and participatory interactive art might be, and what it might be able to enable.
Yeah, I feel we are really like this old social optimists. We really see, like, if the, in relation to technology, I think we still really want to have this spirit of the old web, that somehow technology can also be used to connect people, truly connect people, not in the social media way, like so, but in a really social way. At the same time, if we're realistic, we are also a bit dinosaurs in that regard, I think. simultaneously, yeah, that's also what we are and what we do. So I'm also can carry that with pride, I guess. I don't know. But I don't know. How do you think about that?
Yeah, I think if I see Casper and the program, how it's unfolding every year here, and this year especially also, that people, I mean, the topic of the internet, the people want to make more embodied experiences, or that VR turns into XR, you know, like much more integrated other sensory experiences, or, you know, that you can look through the screen so you can see also the physical world around you at the same time. I think maybe that's also an optimistic way. There will be tendencies to, yeah, get more physical, get more in the space. So I think, yeah, somehow technology maybe gets smaller in that sense, you know, more immersed in that you don't really maybe realize it so much, yeah, you know, that kind of stuff.
I also see my children, if they go out of their house or they want to put their phone away, they want to somehow, they don't want to be, let's say, served like an experience that's only tailored for their Instagram feed. They want something real. They want some real engagement. They want to go home with like some substance or a friend or something that is, and of course, all like you could say in a different way as we used to clubbing or anything when we were young. So it's all way more precise, I think, in some ways, and more considered. But they really want to engage with other people, and I think that's very promising.
Nice. Is there anything else that's left unsaid that you'd like to say to the broader immersive community?
Take off your headset. Yeah. And I think, yeah, make immersive work where physicality, where other people, where you really have to engage with each other, I think, for real, and not only mediated via screen.
Yeah, and I think also a big shout out to all the indie small tech optimists that's still out there that still feel the urge to compete with experience against the big tech mainstream consumer products, because although it's your product seems to be small with a small audience, I think these are the seeds that eventually will be the key to turn over the hegemony of the big tech.
Awesome. Well, Luna and Rule, thanks so much for joining me here on the podcast and to break down a little bit more around the process of Deep Soup and all your conditional design manifesto and a new designing friction manifesto. And yeah, I think that there's another aspect of the participatory nature of this film that I really appreciated after seeing the installation and seeing the context under which those clips were coming in. And reminds me of that early 2004 era, Zay Frank did a whole year-long video blog series where he was including lots of different clips. And I just really appreciate what kind of like creative innovations that happen when you're inviting that kind of user-generated content that kind of help flesh out the deeper themes that you're talking around. And yeah, also just this deeper concept of how friction is such a key part of the physicality of what it means to be an embodied human being in this world today. And we shouldn't forget that as we move into these more layers of abstraction that AI can lead us into. So thanks again for joining me here on the podcast to help break it all down.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. It was very nice.
Lovely conversation. Thanks again.
That's all that we have for today, and I just wanted to thank you for listening to the Voices of VR podcast. If you enjoyed the podcast, then please do spread the word, tell your friends, and consider becoming a member of the Patreon. This is a listener-supported podcast, so I do rely upon donations from people like yourself in order to continue to bring this coverage. You can become a member and donate today at patreon.com/voicesofvr. Thanks for listening.